This is a big time for sports. Next week is baseball's All-Star Game. This weekend is the finals of the World Cup, and the Tour de France bicycle race is well underway. No, we haven't changed Science Friday into a sports call-in show, so don't ask about whether Robbie McEwen can maintain his position in second place in the Tour de France. I don't think I'm going to be able to help you with that, although I don't think he will. Instead, what we're going to do this hour is look at the intersection of science and sport, and we'll start with cycling. Nine riders were forced to withdraw from the Tour de France because of allegations of doping. The detoured athletes are accused of using performance-enhancing drugs, drugs designed, for example, to increase a rider's red blood cell count, thereby increasing his stamina. Joining me now to talk more about the use of illegal drugs, illegal in the sense that you're not supposed to take them in the sport, in cycling and in other sports, is my guest, Dr. Gary Wadler. He's a clinical associate professor of medicine at New York University School of Medicine, and he's also on the World Anti-Doping Agency's Prohibited Lists and Methods Committee. Thanks for joining us today, Dr. Wadler.
Nice being with you.
And if you'd like to join the conversation, again, no predictions on who's going to win these things, just talk about the science. I invite you to give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And so, first of all, I guess the question is, are the substances that cyclists use to improve their performance the same as, you know, sports like baseball or soccer or something like that?
Well, I guess there's an overlap. You know, most of these people who have abused these drugs have gurus who have prescribed or administered or provided an array of drugs in an attempt to enhance performance. Some work in concert with one another. Some are directed at one energy system as opposed to another energy system. Clearly, in endurance events like cycling, EPO, or erythropoietin, the hormone that raises red blood cells, is of paramount interest and really has been one of the real issues that cycling has had to deal with, at least since 1998, when the Festina team was caught with all the equipment, ultimately leading to the development of the World Anti-Doping Agency.
Right. And I guess I just want to remind people that erythropoietin is a drug that's used to help people with certain medical conditions and people who are undergoing chemotherapy. So it's not like it's a banned substance like heroin or something like that.
No, in fact, I think this distinguishes this form of drug abuse from the more traditional notion of drug abuse, which is illicit drugs, cocaine and heroin and marijuana. What we're seeing here is the abuse of very important therapeutic medications. For somebody who has a chronic anemia, as you suggest, for one reason or another, be it kidney disease or chemotherapy or HIV, this means they don't have to be repeatedly transfused. They can maintain higher blood counts. Human growth hormone is an example of some of the best that bioengineering has had to offer in that area, and enables people who otherwise would have been short their whole life or had other growth hormone deficiencies to be treated. Anabolic steroids were, when first developed back in the 1930s, had tremendous therapeutic potential. So unlike traditional drug abuse, and doping is a form of drug abuse, this is the abuse of legitimate drugs for not legitimate purposes.
Right. Can you explain a little bit more about why a cyclist, for example, would want more red blood cells?
Well, cycling in many ways is an endurance event. Sure, it has those events which are more bursts of speed rather than endurance. But from the endurance point of view, clearly getting more oxygen to working muscles enhances the efficacy of that muscle. So you have less fatigue, less cramping. You basically have a muscle that has more fuel being delivered to it and therefore can perform better and for longer periods of time. So prior to that, of course, cycling and doping was dealing in many ways with the transfusion of one's own blood, and so-called autologous transfusions, or somebody else's blood, homologous transfusions. To a degree, people have moved away from that using EPO, which is administered by injection. But because of our ability to better detect EPO, there is some suggestion that some athletes may be shifting back to transfusions, particularly autologous transfusions.
Right.
That is, they put their own blood in the refrigerator, and then prior to a race, they'll reinfuse that blood. The net result is they have more red cells.
Right. And just quickly, how easy is it to detect EPO? Because it's my understanding that it's a natural occurring hormone, so how can you detect it if it's being injected and it's a naturally occurring hormone?
Well, there is a blood test that can distinguish synthetic or recombinant EPO, the sugar molecules on the recombinant EPO are somewhat different from that in naturally occurring EPO, and that really provides the basis for the test. So it's complex technology, but a lot of research has gone into it. It's been well validated, but there are these slight nuanced differences that enable one to determine one's own EPO from synthetic EPO.
Okay. Let's go to the phones now and hear what our listeners have to say about this, and let's start with Jeremy in San Francisco. Jeremy, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. I'm curious as to if you tested, say, 100 athletes at a particular event, are some of these people able to disguise these chemicals that they're using, you know, that some of them actually get away with it? Or, I mean, if you use the same test on everybody, do some of them, you know, do they all get caught if they were all using it? Or do they think that some of them get away with it somehow?
Well, I think we're getting better at detecting this. One of the keys is the fact we don't only test them in competition. We test them out of competition 365 days a year, 24/7, so you never know when you're going to be tested. EPO, you really have to take not just before an event. It has to have a chance to work to raise the red cells, so the timing is crucial. And to the extent that an athlete never knows when they're going to be tested, that's a very important part of the program.
Jeremy, thanks for that call. Let's go now to Richard. Richard, also in San Francisco. Richard, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. I'm just wondering what some of the negative side effects of, say, EPO would be, and would those be the same, say, as if you had trained at high elevation, or?
Interesting, Dr. Wadler.
Good question. High elevations is a subject of immense interest, as are these low oxygen tents, which are designed to have your body raise your own EPO. And there's much debate about the ethics of that. In terms of the side effects, one has to remember there's a disease called polycythemia or erythrocythemia, which the body makes too many red cells. Basically, it does the same thing. And if you get too high a red cell count, your blood basically becomes like thick oil or sludge, and resulting in heart attacks and strokes, particularly in the setting of increased exertion and dehydration. In fact, I had written up a number of years ago when EPO became available in Europe, in the Scandinavian countries, there was an epidemic of deaths in two sports, both endurance sports. One is not known in this country very much, orienteering, and the other was cycling. And I suspect the cause of those deaths was the lack of knowledge as to the dangers of EPO and the notion that more red cells was better and exceeded the levels of any safety and resulted in these tragic outcomes.
Richard, thanks very much for that call. You know, one question that springs to my mind anyway is whether or not there is an established proof that these risky and illegal substances actually make you a better performer, or is this one of these, you know, word-of-mouth, anecdotal kinds of things?
No, it's a good question. HGH, human growth hormone, for example, there's real question whether bigger muscles are necessarily stronger muscles. There are reasons to believe they, in fact, may be weaker muscles. There's no question, on the other hand, that having higher red cell counts, but not in a dangerous range, can enhance performance. Those studies have been done by Ekblom and others many years ago, not necessarily with EPO, but with transfused blood to raise red cell counts. There's no question that that works. there's no question that anabolic steroids enhance performance in a variety of ways. So some of it is hype and not been validated, and some has clearly been validated and you know, it's clearly understandable from a science point of view.
Okay, I think we have time for one more call. Let's go to Chris in Denver, Colorado. Chris, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, I have a question about performance levels. It seems to me exactly that a 1% advantage through EPO or anything else could allow you to put out 490 watts versus 450 watts for an entire stage, whereas the most training could ever give you would be like a 2% edge, and maybe EPO can always give you a 5% edge. So that would lead me to believe that it's like a lot of doping can always happen. Do you have any comment on those level numbers I said?
Well, I'm not a statistician. There's no question that the increments provided by these drugs may not be huge, but there's also no question that those increments have a significant impact on the winners. The time difference between first, second, third, and fourth place in some of these events is, you know, as you suggest, in a matter of seconds, if not minutes. And so there's no question that the outcome is influenced by it. I just don't have the statistical knowledge to answer the question on a statistical basis for you.
Well, Dr. Wadler, just one final quick question. Do you see any new drugs that are looming on the horizon that we might be hearing more about?
Well, we at WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, have very much been keeping our eye on gene therapy. We've had two international meetings now on gene therapy and working with genetic scientists in the laboratory and elsewhere in anticipation of what is going to be an inevitable abuse. As gene therapy becomes more mainstream or actually evolves into our society as a form of therapy, and there's no question history has taught us that that advance will be abused.
Okay. Dr. Wadler, I'm afraid we'll have to interrupt you there because we've come to the end of this segment. Dr. Gary Wadler is a clinical associate professor of medicine at New York University of Medicine. Stay with us. Baseball Among the Numbers is next. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca. Next, our look at science of sports, the statistician as fan. While you're sitting in the bleachers wondering why the sodas cost so much and contemplating whether to have another hot dog, other baseball fans are hard at work multiplying and regressing and compiling the statistics of the game. These days, statistics go way beyond RBIs or ERAs, as virtually no aspect of the game has escaped statistical scrutiny. Joining me now to talk more about what statistics can tell us about the game is my guest. Jonah Carey is editor and co-author of Baseball Between the Numbers, just out from Basic Books. He's also a writer for ESPN.com, and he joins us by phone from Seattle, Washington. Thanks for talking with us today, Dr. Carey.
I wish I was a doctor, but how are you?
Oh, sorry, Mr. Carey. Well,
my wife is a PhD, if that counts.
Well, we can say Mr. Carey, who's married to a doctor.
That's probably a little long.
Okay. you get used to this with talking to doctors, so I forget.
I hear you.
So when did statistics become such an important part of baseball?
Well, they have been for a long time. And, you know, there's been a revolution that's taken place in the last couple of decades. Started with a guy named Bill James, who's an interesting story. He was literally a night watchman at a plant about 30 years ago, and he was very frustrated with the way his hometown Kansas City Royals were playing, and so he started sketching some things out on paper. He didn't have any formal statistical training, but he went about it, and he found some interesting ways to slice and dice the numbers, and that's kind of what these guys who wrote the Baseball Between the Numbers book, people from Baseball Prospectus, along with myself, are all about, where these are not necessarily professional statisticians, interestingly. You know, you've got a meteorologist, a dermatologist, a management consultant, an economist. These are all kinds of different people who happen to be bright people who really understand the game very well. And so they take that kind of outsider's approach, and it makes for some interesting reading.
I want to invite our listeners to join in this because I'm sure there's going to be a lot of questions about that. Our number again is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And, you know, one of the things that strikes me, and even in introducing you, I realize that, you know, as a science correspondent, you know, I've stopped explaining what DNA is, but pretty much everything else has to be explained. And yet somehow sports correspondents can get away without ever explaining what an RBI is or an ERA or any of those things. But now I'm even getting a little confused because there's something called slugging percentage, and I suppose that's common parlance to some people, but what's that?
slugging percentage refers to, basically it's calculated by taking total bases divided by at-bats. So a total base works like this. If you're a batter at a baseball game and you get a single, that's one total base. So one total base over one time at-bat would be a 1,000 slugging percentage. If you hit a home run, that's worth four bases because you've gone around the four bases. So that would be a 4,000 slugging percentage. A good benchmark is if you have a 500 slugging percentage or higher, you are typically a very good hitter, usually a power hitter in today's game.
Uh-huh. And maybe just to be fair to those in the audience who don't know, what is an RBI?
RBI basically involves a player being on base, a baseball player being on base, and a hitter comes to the plate and he delivers some kind of hit or batted ball that delivers the man on base to the plate safely, and that is an RBI. Typically, a benchmark for a high RBI total would be roughly 100 RBIs in a season, although RBIs are often based on opportunity. They don't always reflect ability. It's both a combination of ability and a player's ability to stay healthy and just stay in the lineup every day.
Right. And finally, I guess a quick description of ERA.
ERA is earned runs divided by innings pitched. So it simply means the number of runs that a pitcher gives up over the course of a game, and you project that out to nine innings if you were to pitch a complete game. And earned runs simply means the runs that were, well, earned by the pitcher. Mm-hmm. In other words, they weren't affected by any errors or any miscues that occurred behind him. They were strictly the pitcher's fault.
So all of these things, I mean, these are all what we would call descriptive statistics in the sense that you're not trying to predict anything from them. You're trying to say, how does one player shape up when we look at their performance in a particular way? Is that right?
Well, it is and it isn't. They're definitely descriptive statistics, but there are things that you can intuit and infer, basically, from these statistics that go beyond that. I mean, if you have the ability... Not so much RBI because they're not a very good predictive stat, but for instance, if you're looking at a pitcher's performance and you take his ERA, okay, that starts to tell you something. Now go ahead and take his strikeout rate. In other words, the frequency with which he strikes out opposing hitters. How often does that occur? What we found with the people at Baseball Prospectus who wrote this book, just people in the statistical community in general, have found is that when you look at strikeout rate, that actually does a very good job of predicting, roughly speaking, how a pitcher is going to succeed going forward. If you strike out a lot of hitters, that's really good. Odds are you're a good pitcher, you're going to do well down the road. If you don't strike out a lot of hitters, you need to be a special kind of finesse pitcher and find the ability to generate outs other ways. Otherwise, you're probably going to have some problems.
You know, we were just talking a few minutes ago about performance-enhancing drugs, and of course that's been an issue in baseball as well. I'm wondering if by looking at statistics you can get any kind of a handle on whether or not a particular player his performance has suddenly improved and maybe you'd be more inclined to think that he was taking something.
You can certainly be suspicious of certain things, and you see it on both ends, right? I mean, you're looking at a hitter who has a consistent level of power every year. He hits a certain number of home runs, roughly speaking, and then all of a sudden he has a big spike. Well, you might say, hey, wait a minute, that's kind of out of character. But, I mean, the thing about anything, you know, be it random statistical variants or even human beings, is that sometimes weird things happen and they're hard to explain. And it could be performance-enhancing drugs, or it could be that the guy suddenly has a happy marriage, or it could be that he, you know, got LASIK eye surgery, or it could just be a random happening, a fluke. So it's hard to say. And it works both ways. On the back end, you could have hitters who have been very good for a long time. They've hit a lot of home runs, and suddenly they drop off. And you might say, well, wait a minute. This guy, you know, the restrictions are now tighter against performance-enhancing drugs. It must be that this guy is getting off the juice, and that's why he's not hitting as well. Mm-hmm. Well, that's possible, but it could also be because he's now 37 or 38 years old, or he's coming off a divorce, his dog died. I mean, lots of things happen in life, and players are not stat-generating robots, and it's easy to forget that sometimes.
Well, it's easy for people who collect all these statistics. I think when you go to the baseball game and you see these, I just was there at a local game in the Nationals, you know, they just seem like guys walking up the plate. It's even hard to think that you can predict their performance with some accuracy, but I guess taken as a group, you can.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's take a call now and go to Jason in Naples, Florida. Jason, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I wanted to know a little bit about perhaps how statistics off the field can predict certain things. For example, you know, the curse of the Bambino and, you know, the Cubs have the curse of the goat. And perhaps, you know, what you might notice by statistics on retail sales for a club and what they can tell us about the game.
Well, if you're talking about curses, I mean, that's a thinly veiled excuse to say this team doesn't have a good management. The Red Sox did a very poor job of building teams over the years, and yes, they had Ted Williams and some good players, but by and large, they would make mistakes. They would make ill-advised trades. Certainly trading Jeff Bagwell away when he was a top prospect, that was one very bad move that came back to haunt them. He became a Hall of Fame first baseman with the Houston Astros. They've done all kinds of moves like that. Chicago Cubs are the same way. For years, they were seemed to be more interested in filling up their cozy old ballpark than they were in putting a quality product on the field. And even today, we see that, you know, they're really a poor team right now. So I would say that when you look at curses and you look at things of that nature, I mean, that's just a way of saying, hey, this team hasn't been winning, and we're just going to look for any kind of cause. As far as retail sales and business goes, you know, it's definitely a big help. You know, if you look at, for instance, I'm up here in Seattle, Washington. Seattle Mariners were a low-revenue team for years, and all of a sudden they build a new ballpark. They find ways to maximize revenue streams by signing a bunch of Japanese players such that they get all kinds of new revenue streams coming in. And suddenly they're one of the richest teams in baseball despite playing in, you know, what you could regard as really a mid-market. This is not New York or L.A., and yet the Mariners turn a great profit every year. And, yeah, that helps them on the field.
You know, I'm wondering, has managers begun to take these statistics very much to heart? Because I noticed one of the chapters deals with, you know, where to put your best player. Do you put him as a leadoff batter, or do you put him at the cleanup spot in the fourth position? And there's some suggestion that even though it's counterintuitive, if you let off with Barry Bonds, you might be better off than if you put him in the fourth place. So do managers take this to heart, or are there so many rules in baseball that are perceived wisdom that the numbers aren't going to convince anybody?
Well, first of all, I should preface this by saying that the chapter you're referring to, the title of that chapter is actually, Was Billy Martin Crazy?
Yeah, sure.
You know anything about Billy Martin, you know that he was a little bit crazy, and that's one of the beauties of this book where, yeah, there's some statistics involved, and it has a little bit of detail, but there's some really fun stuff. I mean, if you're getting into a chapter like, What Was Billy Martin Crazy? Well, it's compelling. It's the kind of stuff you're going to argue about in a bar, over beers, with your friends, even if you're not necessarily a statistical wizard. As far as your question, there are lots of ways to go about it. I mean, generally, you do want to see your best hitters get the most at-bats, and it does become a little bit frustrating when teams say, well, this guy's going to be my number four or number five hitter because we feel like he could drive in runs. Well, if he's your best player, it's pretty logical that you just want to get him to the plate as much as possible. And if he's your number four or number five hitter, he's going to bat less often than your number one hitter. It's not so much that you're wasting your power hitters by putting them in the middle of the lineup. The biggest problem is when teams try to go with these antiquated ideas of what makes for a leadoff hitter. In other words, back in the day, 30, 40 years ago, when the game was, a lot of it was about speed and really close 2-1, 3-2 kind of games, yes, there was an advantage to having a guy who could steal a lot of bases at the top of your lineup. In today's game, if you get caught stealing, that is a big disadvantage because the next guy could just very easily hit a 2-run home run. So you're basically erasing a potential run off the board if you get caught. You're better off finding a guy who's going to get on base a lot versus a guy who's going to steal a lot of bases. And to give you a current example, Boston Red Sox have two players. One is named Coco Crisp, funnily enough, actually, one of the best names in baseball.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is a guy named Kevin Youkilis. Kevin Youkilis is a big hulking guy who walks all the time and always gets on base. He is not fast. Coco Crisp is a little water bug who is very fast but does not get on base very much. At first, they were going to go with Crisp as a leadoff player in the traditional mold of a leadoff guy, but eventually they decided to use Youkilis, and their offense has benefited very much from that. Getting the better hitter up there is a much better strategy than worrying about a fast guy at the top of the lineup.
Well, I agree with you that Coco Crisp is a great name. I'm still very partial to Biff Pocoroba.
Oh, right? Biff Pocoroba is definitely a classic from the 1980s, Atlanta Braves.
Right, there you go. Well, I think we're going to leave it there. It's a fascinating, it's a book that will, there's so many mathematical tables and formula, you'll be maybe put off, but if you stick with it, as you say, there's a lot of interesting stuff in there. So thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jonah Carey is editor and co-author of Baseball Between the Numbers, and he's also a writer for ESPN.com. And now from one ball sport to another. And believe it or not, outside of the United States, this is the sport that everybody cares the most about, and this is the time everybody cares most about that sport, and that's because we're in the middle of the World Cup. And the sport, of course, is soccer, or as it's known to the rest of the world, football. When France and Italy face off this Sunday, they'll be joined by a German called Team Geist. That's the name Adidas gave to their new soccer ball designed especially for this year's World Cup. Now, conventional soccer balls are made up of 26 or 32 of these little hexagons stitched together. But Team Geist doesn't look like that at all. It has just 14 panels, making it, according to my next guest, behave more like a baseball. Joining me to talk about that is Ken Bray. He's a visiting professor of the University of Bath in England, and he joins us by phone. Thanks for talking with us today, Dr. Bray.
You're very welcome. Very welcome, Joe.
Well, so, okay, first of all, do you have any idea why they changed the design of the soccer ball?
Well, they changed it for one basic reason. They changed it for commercial interest. And each World Cup, you produce a new ball, and you make more sales, and your company becomes a little more profitable.
Yeah, if anybody's interested, I mean, I think of soccer balls as costing, you know, I don't know how much they cost in the UK, but $20 or $30. But if you call up the distributor for Adidas in this country, you have to spend $130 to get one of these new balls.
Well, that's about the same in UK sterling. And in fact, our goalkeeper, Paul Robinson, complained because he wanted to learn about the characteristics of this new ball. He had to have his agents go out and buy six of the damn things at £80 sterling a piece so he could learn its properties before he began to prepare for his share of the World Cup. And that's a big outlay.
Especially because he had to go home before it was over. But anyway, that's another story.
Joe, we won't get into that.
No.
In my opinion, we went home too soon, but there's always another time.
That's true. We're talking about the physics of sports, and in particular, the way the new soccer ball used in the World Cup is flying. I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Okay, so explain to me why a ball with these funny-shaped panels and only 14 of them would behave differently than one with these stitched regular pattern of hexagons.
Okay. Well, if you take the classical hexagon ball, 32 panels, implicitly it has more seam, and we never knew for many, many years. In fact, it was the seam, the stitching between the panels, that gave the ball aerodynamic stability. So we moved down from a 32-panel ball with lots of seam through the 26-panel ball, the characteristic English ball, right down to the new Teamgeist, which has only got 14 panels. 14 panels, less seam, and in my view, that makes the ball much closer to a baseball in its performance than, in fact, to the classic 32-panel type.
Now, is it going to behave the same way if it's spinning than if it's hit with virtually no spin?
Well, this is the point. If the ball is spun, as we saw in the World Cup, it behaves pretty well as you'd expect. It's very like a curveball, which is thrown in baseball. But if this ball doesn't spin, the new ball, or it spins very little, in fact, you get the seam dodging in and out of the airflow, very like the limited seam on a baseball. And in fact, it's quite like a knuckleball pitch in baseball. And if you get this seam dodging in and out of the airflow, the aerodynamic force, the aerodynamic instability, switches on and off. And so the ball bobs about in flight. Now, that's very disconcerting for a goalkeeper, just as a knuckleball is very disconcerting for a batter in baseball.
Well, and also for the catcher who has to catch it more often than the batter has to hit it.
Quite so.
Well, let's take one quick call here from Mike in Holland, Michigan, who's been waiting patiently. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hi. I've got the ball, and the thing that you haven't mentioned, when you kick it, it sort of sings. It makes almost a musical thump. I've noticed that it does accelerate, but paradoxically, it feels lighter on the foot but heavier on the head to me. And I was wondering if you knew anything, what would cause that?
Singing soccer balls. Thanks, Mike. Go ahead, Dr. Bray.
Well, I've seen this ball. We've tested this ball to a limited extent. We tested it with a Nike ball, and I wasn't aware that it pinged or sang any differently from a conventional kick. But, you know, the weight of the ball, its recoil, its size, its sphericity, it's very carefully controlled under the FIFA regulations. So we shouldn't expect too much different in terms of things like dimensionality, weight, and bounce and so on from any other ball. But the point is, there is no FIFA regulation for aerodynamic performance. There's none at all for how the ball is expected to swerve if it's kicked with spin or if it's kicked very characteristically like a knuckleball.
Until we get
some kind of standard, manufacturers will continue to produce a ball that might behave unpredictably for each of these competitions.
Yeah. I wonder, is there any evidence, and we don't have much more time, but is there any evidence that you can actually kick this ball further than you could the hexagon ball? Because I certainly have seen the goalkeepers, kick the ball back and forth to one another, seeming to eliminate the players in the middle altogether.
Well, I think that's more due to the development of kicking technique. If you want to kick a ball a long distance, it's very like a golf drive. You kick the ball so it rotates with backspin, and if you do this, it floats because it stays in the air longer. And really, the Teamgeist, in my view, doesn't perform drastically differently from a conventional ball when it's kicked by a goalkeeper. But if you kick it in terms of a shot at goal, or if you kick it in a free kick, you don't get much spin. Watch out.
Yeah.
For example, Fabien Barthez, the French keeper, had great difficulty in catching some of the shots that are that the Portuguese delivered. And if this happens against Italy, I forecast that he will be in some serious problems.
So one word, Italy or France?
I'm going to go for Italy.
Okay, we have to leave it there. We'll find out if you're right. I'd like to thank my guest, Ken Bray. He's visiting professor at the University of Bath in England, and he talked with us from England. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, more about soccer balls. Well, actually, no more about soccer balls, but a lot about frogs. Stay with us.